Hello, I'm Andy Cross, and welcome to my talk on devices and Windows Azure, showcasing the openness of Windows Azure. Now, these are two of my main passions, and Windows Azure being the cloud is exceptionally large, and devices being exceptionally small and resource constrained are the opposite. So bringing those two together in union is something which is very interesting. If there are two things that I'd like you to take away from this session, is that these very small resource constrained devices can be expanded and turbocharged with the power of the cloud, but also that the cloud itself is an exceptionally open thing, and Microsoft Windows Azure is an exceptionally open platform that you can interact with without having to use client libraries. You're not locked into Microsoft, you can do it all yourself, and I'll demonstrate that by interacting with the cloud from devices which don't even have operating systems on them. So, who am I? I'm Andy Cross, I'm a Windows Azure MVP, and I work for ElastiCloud, which is a UK-based consultancy in cloud computing and Windows Azure. And I also founded the UK Windows Azure user group. In my professional life, I do HPC, big data, and my private life and my hobbies, as I was looking after my beautiful daughter, Mariella, and my wife, Roxanne, I build little tiny microchips and interact with the cloud. And today I'm going to outline a scenario around devices and how they interact with the cloud. And as we go through, you'll see my progression before you can all go and have a nice cup of coffee somewhere. So let's talk about devices. One of the interesting things about devices is that they're next to ubiquitous. They are absolutely everywhere. The Internet of Things is this terminology for this great number of internet-connected devices which connect over the public internet to back-end services in order to expand their capacity and interact with humans, which is often one of the main reasons they exist. The number of devices is currently 9 billion, which is quite staggering. It's 9 billion real devices in the real world connecting over the internet. And it's set to skyrocket to 24 billion by 2020. Now, I did a little bit of maths on this, and using a Node.js server, which is regarded for being particularly quick and able to handle very concurrent requests, if each of these 9 billion requests, that's not to mention the 24 billion in the next few years, but if each of these 9 billion devices connected just once to a server, and that server was able to handle 2.4 thousand requests a second, which is a benchmark for Node, then you would need 100,000 servers to be able to actually cope with this amount of traffic. The scalability challenge around devices is actually more than just the weight of load. It's that the type of traffic is actually a little bit unpredictable or predictable, which is interesting to have to try and cope with. Predictable devices may report periodically, such as hourly readings from a meter or some kind of sensor. Devices may also interact very, very frequently to retrieve news. Unpredictable workloads, such as user-oriented workloads, may only happen when somebody interacts with the device itself, such as a refrigerator, where someone takes milk out and it scans that's left, orders new milk to be ordered from the grocers, and then has to send that up as a message to the cloud. But that's infrequent and unpredictable. Also, if they're trying to communicate with each other through some kind of peer discovery mechanism, then of course this is not something which is particularly easy to predict. Now, it's my contention that only a scalable, elastic computing infrastructure can solve this challenge without having a huge cost up front, which makes it prohibitive. And this sort of infrastructure is provided by Windows Azure. Let's just go very briefly over devices and the types of devices that we'll be covering today. Desktop devices are the traditional devices that we're all familiar with. They're PCs and they're laptops, and their type of interaction is oriented around a user. There may be some background processes communicating up to the cloud, but mainly it's to do with user interaction. Mobile devices, again, to do with the user using it, but also background processes, and additionally some other types of device communication that are slightly new, such as push notifications and location-sensitive information gathering. Now, you can see that the progression from desktop to mobile is actually changing and increasing the amount of traffic, the amount of exhaust which comes out of these devices, because there are new ways that they can communicate, the new things they want to communicate for. And that's actually increased by an order of magnitude by embedded devices, because embedded devices exist solely to capture information around their environment and to transmit that up to the cloud. It's what they're there for. So I'd like to give an example of the Nike Plus, which was like a pedometer that you would insert into your shoe. And as you were doing exercise, it would transmit, tethered by a mobile phone, your information about your exercise that you were performing up to a cloud-based or internet-based service, where you could then later go and check the information about your exercise and track your actual personal experience with that device. Now, the thing about that is that it's gathering information all the time. It's gathering information all the time without sleeping, without taking a break. Its exhaust, its digital exhaust from this device is absolutely massive, and it will dwarf, in terms of a comparison with a human, the amount of input that we would do, because we often go to sleep. So these devices don't, and they continually send information up. So the future is going to be about devices which communicate a lot more than humans communicate, about humans' environments, but also about other devices and interacting with devices. And this sort of communication is only set to increase. So just to illustrate how I see these particular spheres of computing, desktop computing has the highest capacity in terms of resource. So the device itself, what is it capable of? Even now, mobile devices, which are increasingly complex and increasingly capable, are not able to match the capacity of a desktop machine because of its form factor. The desktop machine is larger by an order of magnitude, at least, from a mobile device. And so, therefore, you can have more things in it, which makes it a much more capable device. The cost of mobiles is, though, higher per capacity than in the desktop realm, where desktop devices are very capable at a lower cost than mobile devices, which, because the technology is newer and is still evolving, it's a very forefront technology, the cost per unit is quite high. The potential between those two is that the desktop environment, if we compare them, the desktop environment isn't going to grow that much. It may grow, it may stay the same, but not compared to mobiles, which is and has increased rapidly over the recent years and is still set to continue to increase as technology increases and coverage of networks increase, so people in faraway places, not near a main city, can still use these technologies. I contrast both of those with embedded technologies, which is where we're going to focus most of the session today. Embedded technologies are not very capable at all. They are resource constrained. They have gone for the low cost of unit or the small form factor, exceptionally small form factor, rather than going for high capacity. The cost per unit is absolutely critical to these devices. They're often mass manufactured. They are sent away to factories and they come out and they're distributed globally. And they have to compete in a very, very difficult business scenario where the cost of a single device is incredibly important. But the potential for these devices, we saw at the start, from 9 billion devices today to 22 billion devices in only 8 years, that is a huge potential and it dwarfs all the rest. And quite importantly, the reason for that potential is that it's not related. There's not a direct correlation between devices and individuals. So an individual owns a desktop. An individual owns a mobile. Maybe an individual owns two mobiles or two desktops. But in the future, people will own many active shoes, many coats which detect when it's raining outside, all kinds of devices which currently are simply dumb devices will become smart devices. And those smart devices will communicate over the internet to scalable cloud resources, and the potential is massive. So let's look at the familiar form factors and what they provide from a technology point of view. Desktops, resource rich. You can do next to anything with a desktop. They are incredibly capable devices. Mobile devices are wealthy and increasing, and maybe there will be a point where they reach parity. Maybe if desktop devices stop to evolve because the market for them shrinks, maybe mobile devices will become the dominant resource device in the world. The type of programming available to write clients is very rich in both. HTML for web interfaces works almost identically between smartphones and desktops, and WPF on a Microsoft platform is a very rich way of creating a client. Silverlight are similar technology on mobile devices and other proprietary technologies for other vendors provide very rich and functional clients. In terms of Windows Azure support, there's fantastic support across desktops in all kinds of different languages, whether we're talking about server-side languages or client-side languages or a combination of the two. You can write applications on the desktop in a variety of ways and have great support for Windows Azure. And on mobile devices, there are some fantastic tools provided by Microsoft and the open source community for all different types of platforms, for iOS, for Android, for Windows Mobile. And in terms of communication, let's just compare those lastly. On a desktop environment, we can communicate over HTTP and HTTPS and general sockets on Windows. And also, of course, on a full desktop machine, we have access to things like USB, serial devices and peripherals, and other types of connections into other devices. On a mobile device, it's primarily over web protocols, over HTTP and HTTPS. And most mobile devices don't come with things like serial ports, or some come with USB ports, but a large number don't. And if we compare that with embedded devices, this is a real challenge with rewards. An embedded device has a very limited amount of processor capacity. It has a very limited amount of memory. It may have no operating system at all. It may be code running directly on a microcontroller. And it may have partial or no cryptography libraries. But compare that with the rewards you get from these. You have many communication channels available, from USB to serial and other types of devices that can be communicated with over various different protocols. Low-level code can be extremely efficient, more efficient than anything you'll find on any of the higher-level languages on desktops or mobiles. Close access to hardware allows you to control things that you otherwise cannot control from these other operating systems. And the form factor is one of the biggest differentiators. You can produce incredibly small devices that can be wearable, that can be embedded into things that you wouldn't even know was a smart device. And in fact, this is where the future is. The future is in smart devices that you don't even realize are smart devices. So if we think about Windows Azure and embedded technologies, what do we really think about? Well, we think about scalable resources that can lift the constraints on these devices. If we have a device which can only store a megabyte of data on its memory, then we can provision an elastic storage capacity in the cloud of hundreds of terabytes. And then, providing we can communicate up to that cloud resource, we can send all the data that we're gathering on the device up to the cloud and not have to worry about the capacity of the device itself. Furthermore, we can do that with compute. So if we have a very low-powered computing device, the microprocessor itself may not be able to do very many calculations in a set period of time. But if it's trying to do something arithmetically complex, for example, you could just offload that to a cloud-based cluster, maybe a HPC cluster, which could crunch the numbers and return a simple result down to the device that then can act upon it. We can also talk about infrastructure services that are available, media services for streaming very low quality video, maybe down to these not very capable devices, but still enough to satisfy what the device can do. And mobile services can be used with these embedded devices for very simple back-end systems and get up and running quickly. Big data we'll come back to later on, but it's incredibly important to think about if there are 22 billion internet-connected devices in the world and they just send up a little bit of information to a centralized server, that's going to end up being a huge amount of data very, very quickly. So how do I go over that data trying to extract value? How do I get what is inside my data out and make some sense of it when I've got so much of it? And that's where big data comes in. And I'm going to show you some architectures which are going to show some of these turbocharging and compute lifting later on, two using storage, and one using the service management API. So Windows Azure provides scalable mechanisms which can lift resource constraints on embedded devices. For instance, by accessing network services, a limited resource device can access terabytes of storage. Well, that's all good. What's the catch? Well, there's no Windows Azure client for embedded devices. We can't just download one, stick it on the chip, and it'll run. We're going to have to write our own. Now, this is one of my main points of this demo, so I just want to talk about this for a few seconds. We simply cannot do this if there's a walled garden which doesn't let us see how these systems work. If there was some kind of proprietary protocol which wasn't accepted or understood across the web, something which we might have seen in the 90s, this would not be able to communicate with devices, and devices wouldn't be able to communicate with it because there wouldn't be an understanding of how this actually works. So it's very important, and it's very evident that Windows Azure, by the fact that these demos hopefully will work later on, it's an open platform. It's a platform which doesn't revolve itself around not sharing its secrets about how it works. It's something which you can embrace and use from chips without any operating system at all and still get an excellent service from Windows Azure. But we keep talking about these devices. What do we mean by those devices? Where can we find a device that doesn't have an operating system? Today, we'll be talking about the .NET MicroFramework, or NetMF to its friends. I'll give you a little bit of background about it. It started in around 2005 in Microsoft by a team called the Smart Personal Objects Technology Team, or Microsoft SPOT. They produced a watch, a wearable device, which had an embedded microprocessor inside it. And the purpose of this watch was not just to tell the time, but to reach out over network protocols, pick up the news, pick up the weather, and display it on your wrist. So it's quite an advanced piece of technology that actually allowed you to interact with things beyond just your person. It managed to reach out and find news about the world and pull it down onto your wrist. In 2007, it was renamed from Microsoft SPOT to NetMF, or .NET MicroFramework. And in 2009, it was open sourced. The entire framework is open source. You can go to netmf.coplex.com, and I recommend you do that. And you can go to this website and you can see the source code. You can see how the .NET framework, well, the microframework, works. You can download it if you're having a problem, and you can step through it. And it's an amazing thing that you can step through the code that actually is underpinning a huge amount of your software. In 2010, netmf.com was launched, which is a community site around the .NET microframework, and it has things like projects, case studies of people who have been successful, and stories about how you can use it for future case studies, videos and the like. But what is the .NET microframework and where does it fit? Well, it's .NET for devices. Scott Hanselman famously said that it was hardware for software guys, which I think is a really good sort of summary. It's a very high-level language on top of very low-level things, but it works on devices of a very resource-constrained nature. For example, you only need 64 kilobytes of RAM to be able to run the .NET microframework, and you don't need a memory management unit. You can have it emulated in the software, all taken care of for you. But let's really get into the why you would use a .NET microframework. And the why, the two real reasons for me. Number one, it's C# or VB.NET on a chip. You can reuse your existing understanding of programming. You don't have to go down to the super low level and reinvent the wheel, relearn all of your skills. If you know C# or you know VB, you can pick up this framework, write standard or very close to standard .NET framework classes and deploy it onto a microchip. And when I talk about deploying, this is the other factor. You deploy through Visual Studio. You use Visual Studio to debug through your code, to check that it's working and to interact with it at runtime. Anyone who's done any embedded software development or knows anyone who's done embedded software can tell the pain on the lines of their face of what it's like to debug a normal embedded processor at runtime when something happens like you run out of memory. And you run out of memory, so there's nowhere to put the error trace. There's no way of logging out what's going on and what's happened. And you spend days and days and days debugging the software because it's not a modern tooling environment. And most embedded software does not have the strength of modern computer science and modern software development behind it. But the .NET microframework does. With industry-leading tools like Visual Studio, you can debug your software at runtime, find any problems, diagnose them, fix them, redeploy through a USB cable, straight onto the chip, and then again, step through line by line what's happening. I'll show you this in some demos later on. But where does it fit? There are quite a few .NET frameworks, as you're probably aware. There's the full .NET framework, which requires quite a bit of device resource. It's not a massive overhead for modern computers, but it does need quite a bit of resource. and it's quite complex for that. You can do all kinds of exciting things like dynamic languages on that. The Compact framework is almost a halfway house. It's slightly cut down version. It's a subset of the entire .NET framework. But you can run it on small devices, devices which are more resource constrained, things like handhelds, you know, maybe not a phone in particular, but something else, something which is quite resource rich, but not properly resource rich, a middle ground. And the .NET micro framework is for very resource constrained devices. It is not as complex and comprehensive as the other ones. It looks very similar. You'll find some very key classes and some very key objects that you're used to don't have all the properties that you're used to. There are workarounds, there are things you can do to implement them, and there are community support which helps you implement these things. So you can almost always do what you're hoping to do, but it might look just subtly different from what it would look like if it was in the full .NET framework. But the benefit of that is because it's smaller, you can run it on these devices which are not very resource rich. So I just want to talk about the devices that I'm using today. I'm using something called a Netduino Plus, which is made by Secret Labs, who are a company with a fantastic following. I recommend you go to netduino.com. They have a great community site, and the reason I'm giving this plug, and they're not paying me for this, is because of their community helped me a lot of times during my learning of the .NET micro framework. And they have great facilities on the website, in the forums, and on an IP chat that you can just go in and ask any old questions, and people will be there to help you, which is just amazing for someone who starts off as a hobbyist. You can interact with people who've been doing this for a professional living for many years, and they are always so friendly and helpful that, you know, I really recommend that that is a great website to go for help. What the chip is, it's an Amtel 32-bit microprocessor. It's got 48 megahertz ARM7 on board and code storage of 64 kilobytes. That means you can only write software that compiles into binaries that are smaller than 64 kilobytes. If you want to compile the software and the firmware and take out networking support, and we'll come back to that in a second, then you can actually run more complicated applications. There are 42 kilobytes of RAM, which is not very much, so if you want to try and load anything in memory, you've got to be very careful, and I'll show you some techniques later on. And again, without networking, then you can run slightly more memory. But let's come back to what do I mean, networking. Okay, so the Netduino Plus has got an onboard Ethernet adapter and Ethernet chip. So just by plugging in a standard Ethernet cable, you can connect to the internet. And this is where our entire demo will be based today. We're going to connect to the internet through its onboard Ethernet jack, and we are going to use its other facilities in order that we can interact with the world at large. What other facilities? Well, we're going to use its micro USB port for debugging. We're going to use its inputs, digital outputs, and analog inputs for detecting what's happening in the real world and interacting with that. We're going to use its onboard switch for doing some very simple things. And we're going to use its micro SD card for storing data on locally before we batch it up to the cloud. So maybe we should just have a little talk about what this Netduino idea is and where it came from. Well, it's from a family, a great family of hobbyist and increasingly commercial chips and development plates called Arduino, coming from this sort of inspiration of Arduino. And an Arduino is an Italian company who made a very popular device that you write in C++. Now that Arduino is open source hardware, and that's a little bit different because normally we think about open source and we think open source software. But this is open source hardware, and it means the manufacturers have allowed their schematics to be published in the open world so that we can interact with them, we can make our own versions, and we can improve upon them over time. All these sort of great things about open source, but applied to hardware. Now, Arduino has this great following, community following, and people who are working with it, and they create these things called shields. Now, a shield is a device which sits on top of an Arduino, the main board of the Arduino, and connects in with its pins. If you can see over on the slide, the blue things at the top and bottom of the board are pins. And if you plug devices on top of them and they fit snugly on top, then whatever the device is on top can use those pins to communicate with the chip inside. Now, this has led to a development of people who think, right, well, a lot of people want to do things with LEDs, so I'll make a shield that sits on top and allows people to program LEDs very, very simply. Or maybe it uses Wi-Fi or maybe RFID or some other type of technology. And all you'd have to do is buy the shield and the Arduino and plug them on top. So how does that fit into Netduino? Well, I'll demonstrate this with a couple of photos or a video camera that I have on the desk here in a second. The fact is these are pinout identical, so that you can take anything which fits on top of the Arduino and put it onto the Netduino and any of the other devices which are very similar in their pinout. And that means that if you know that it works with an Arduino, you can almost always take the same shield and just put it on top of a Netduino and use it from .NET. Now, because Arduino is written in a C++ style, and so it's maybe not as easy and as readily available to debug, and certainly not to someone who's as familiar with C# as I am, to write in C++. Instead, I would prefer to write in .NET, which is why I would choose the .NET Micro Framework and the Netduino. So I'm just going to show you what I mean by identical pinouts. If you just bear with me while I put on screen my camera. I apologize for the slight problem with focus. I'm sure it'll pick it up in a minute. It's an autofocus mode, so in a second I'm sure it will work out. So this I'm going to put in front of you now is an Arduino. Although I can't get it out of the bag, typical. Okay. Now, will it focus? Come on, camera, give me some focus. Maybe I'll just pick the chip up. Where are you focusing? Oh dear, this isn't going so well. Okay, well, I'll show you in blurriness then. I'm sure it will pick up the focus very soon. That is an Arduino with its pins here and here and a power jack and a onboard microprocessor. Next to it here, we have a Netduino. And I'm hoping you can see the similarity between these two devices. It's not very clear on the screen, unfortunately. Let me try adjusting that again. Autofocus continuous, now that sounds better. Aha, aha, excellent, hooray! Ha, excellent, edit that out, that didn't happen. So here we can see an Arduino here with its pinouts, and next to it, the Netduino, which has got exactly the same number of pins, as you can see, the blue, light blue, and the dark, well, the black on the Arduino are identical. So that is the Netduino. Now, I'm not using a Netduino, I'm using a Netduino Plus. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's put this next to them as well. Here we can see a Netduino Plus. Now, a Netduino Plus is, again, identical in terms of its pinout. You can see that the blue, very clearly now you can see the blue on the Netduino Plus, the blue pinouts, are equivalent to the Netduino and in the same positions as the Arduino, which means that any device that you can get which sits on top of these and communicates with the underlying board can be lifted off the Arduino, put onto either of these two devices, and you can instantly start programming them in a .NET Micro Framework. And I actually have the pleasure of announcing something. So if we just go back over here. So I can show you a Netduino 2, because the wonderful guys at Channel 9, who are hosting us at the Windows Azure conference today, have one. And they've let me show it on screen. So this is a Netduino 2. It's brand new. It was literally announced last week by the great guys over at Netduino and Secret Labs. And it is fantastically more capable. It's still a resource-constrained device, so the rest of the talk, luckily, is still valid. But it's about six times as much memory, It's certainly a lot quicker in terms of the amount of capacity on its speed, on its microcontroller. And it has much more RAM available to use. So I'm going to unbox one here that I have, which is very exciting for me because I do like these things. So here we go. This is the box that it comes in. Here we go. And I'll put it alongside. I haven't seen this. So this is all, hopefully it's not like some kind of cracker inside it or something. Like one of those Chinese snakes. Something like this. Let's open it up. All very exciting. Don't drop it, Andy, don't drop it. Wow. There we go. Let's put it alongside. So there you go, a Netduino Plus 2. And you can compare it to the Netduino Plus. It's very, very similar. Let's take these away now. They're old now, they're old school. We don't need them anymore. Here they are, side by side. Very, very similar. You can see you can barely tell the difference between the two. Obviously it has Netduino Plus 2 written on it and it's stamped, that's a good sign. And you can actually see that the chip actually seems to be quite a little bit smaller, the main processor on it, which is quite staggering really, given that it's quicker. But anyway, that's my excitement over for the day. And let's go back to talking about the .NET Micro Framework, and let's go back to talking about some software and the cloud. Okay. So, I'm still going to use the Netduino Plus that I had because I've written my code for that and I haven't had time to deploy to it. Obviously, I've just unbagged it. But in order to do that, it would simply be a case of plugging in my USB cable, going into Visual Studio and pressing the debug, and it would send the software down the cable to the device and then would instantly launch a debugging session. So it would be very, very simple to do that. I'm not going to risk it, and particularly as well because my Netduino Plus that I have over here is wired up to a couple of devices that I'm going to be using for the rest of my talk, and I don't fancy unwiring them and putting the back in. If I get them in the wrong ports, it won't work. So, back to the talk. One second. Okay, so a very quick tour of the .NET Micro Framework, the fundamentals. We're going to do three proper primers. And this is the introduction to those. So what is the .NET Micro Framework? It's about development, it's about devices, and it's about delivery. You write in C# or Visual Basic. Visual Basic, by the way, is only a very recent addition. It's primarily been a C# environment before. You use Visual Studio, and you can even use Express, so you don't have to pay for the environment. You can just download the Express edition, add on top of the SDK, which allows you to write with the .NET Micro Framework, and you can get going in literally maybe half an hour or so. You debug and deploy via USB, and debugging works. And I can't stress how important this is and how wonderful this is. You can step through every single line of code in your application. Breakpoints are hit and are respected. You can use the immediates window. You can have watches and autos. And you know, you can use the entire IDE and have a world industry-leading IDE for writing embedded software. It's about devices. It's about open source hardware. So not only is the Arduino open source hardware, in that you could pick up your own and make your own Arduino if you wanted to, or improve upon it if you thought you could, instead you can actually get the Netduino's open source schematics and you can download those. And maybe if you wanted to make a device because your software works so well and it's so popular on these Netduino's, obviously like my demos will be, then you can just download the Netduino's schematics and maybe try and work out how to shrink that. Maybe you don't need all the pins. Maybe you don't need the Ethernet, which of course we will do for our demos, but not everyone would. Maybe you need a different type of power jack. Maybe you don't need a USB adapter. So you could adapt it any way you want, send that off to a manufacturer, and they would produce whatever it was that you made the specifications say. So you can make your own custom .NET Micro Framework boards. You can design your own, and you can go to quite low levels making specialized equipment. If you don't want to do that, if you're a hobbyist like I am, you might want to look at some other types of technology that are around that don't necessarily require soldering. My soldering is awful. And luckily, I got all the way from England to Seattle via an airline, of course, without the solder falling apart, which I'm absolutely staggered at. But no. Demos coming up, only time will tell. But if, like me, you're a little bit shy of soldering, and you want to look at another approach, there's a technology and a device called the .NET Gadgeteer, which is a little bit old, maybe is a little bit compromised in terms of its design. There's also one called the Netduino Go, which is an improvement upon that in my regard. What that is sort of devices and peripherals, like low-level devices, like LEDs maybe, and maybe Ethernet ports, or maybe some kind of RFID adapter or something, that you can buy, and rather than having to solder them in and have wires and all the things that you can see down here, which isn't very pretty, and is quite complex and is a bit of a skill, actually a bit of an art to be able to solder properly, then you can just snap them in. They snap onto the main board and then they're firmly on, and then you can just interact with them through your code and not have to worry about the physical electrical connections between the devices. And it's about delivery. When you complete your software, you publish it, and it becomes a firmware on top of the standard firmware, and you distribute that across to your manufacturers, your device manufacturers, and they burn it onto the ROM, and when it ships out, it's there. It's a very simple way of doing this, and it's just going debug and deploy, and then debug and publish. And you can get the software which comes out at the end of it, and ship that off to your manufacturer, and you don't have to worry about doing any of the complicated burning of ROMs. So I'll very quickly talk about the architecture before we go on to our proper primers. The architecture of the .NET Micro Framework is that you write user code, which is telling the device how to work and what it should do. Microsoft and the community have provided the .NET Framework classes, which control many, many things around runtime logic. But someone else has done some work as well, and they're the device vendors. They've picked up something called the .NET Micro Framework Porting Kit, and they have made a specific way for their devices to interact between the .NET Micro Framework and the low-level chip. So they've effectively done the hard low-level work for you. And I like to think of it as maybe the .NET Micro Framework is a series of interfaces, and underneath that there are implementations. So those implementations can be different between different devices, but you, in terms of the user code at the top, just consumes the interfaces. Now you just consume, it's not actually C# interfaces, it's just that sort of concept. You're consuming a veneer, and underneath that there's separate code which is doing device-specific work. So let's go on to a primer around general purpose input-output, because we're using this in all of our demonstrations. Now, as it says, it's about input and output, and it's about a pin being able to be capable of doing both. So you connect a device to a particular pin on the main board, and then you configure the chip to accept data from it or send data down it. And you do that using code. So in this example, we're using a standard C# class with namespace, as you might imagine them, like using system.threading, all the standard types of .NET Framework namespaces, with some additional ones like Microsoft.spot and secretlabs.netmf.hardware, which is specific stuff just to help around coding the Netduino. It tells you things about where pins are on the board, and it helps for configuration. But it's not a particularly complicated set of classes there. That's not the firmware I was talking about just before. You might notice this looks almost identical to a C# console application, in that it's a static void main, but there are no arguments in the parameters for that main method, because, of course, this is not going to be invoked by the command line. It's going to run on the chip. You create an analog input class, and then you read from it, and that's all you do. You do analog input dot read, and it gives you the value of whatever's on that pin at that point in time. So how do we do output? You just create an output port. Simple as that. In code, you say output port LED flasher equals new output port, and tell it which port and which pin to communicate down. In this case, we're using the onboard LED. So what this code will do is flash the onboard LED on this device, and then sleep for 20 milliseconds. It's very familiar, and hopefully, if you've done a few console apps in the past, you'll see this is very simple. And simple things like while loops in C# and using system threading to sleep a thread, this is all very familiar, and it should be a comfortable thing for you to be used to. So let's get on to something a little bit less comfortable. Cryptography. Cryptography in the Micro Framework, it's quite large. So if you try and use it on the Netduino, you'll quite likely run into this, which is a not implemented exception. No, sorry, it's a not supported exception. And what that means is that on that particular device, you can't use the cryptography frameworks. Now, that is a bit of a problem if you're trying to do things over the web, over HTTPS or something like that. But don't panic, don't despair. This is C#. So you can just write your own cryptography libraries. For Azure, you have to use SHA-256 hashes all over the place, so you can just get an open source version from microframework.nl by this person called Elsie Cool, who has produced this implementation. It's open source, so you can get it, so thank you very much, whoever you are in Norway. And you can just use it, and it works out of the box. So there might not be onboard cryptography, but because it's C#, it's a familiar place, and you can actually get a version that works and just put it on the chip yourself. And finally, the last primer, NetIO. So how do we use sockets and networks in the .NET micro framework? Well, unsurprisingly, it's very simple. It's very similar as well to standard C#.NET, in that you create a system.net.http web request. And you do that by creating a web request with a URI, and then you call getResponse, and then you call getResponseStream on that response, and you can check things like the response statuses and whether it has that response. And then you can use something like a stream reader to read that stream down into a string, and then manipulate that however you like. Now, there's a problem with this, in that if we remember that it only has 40 kilobytes of available memory, if you're downloading something which happens to be 41 kilobytes, you'll get an out-of-memory exception. So one of the techniques that you'll see in the rest of our demos is that we use a buffered approach. So rather than using a stream reader to read the entire thing, instead we'll use it to just read chunks at a time and put the output from that chunk at a point in time. So rather than loading an entire stream at 41 kilobytes into memory and running out, we'll just load 1 kilobyte at a time and then do what we need to do with that and then move on to the next. So we'll move on to our demos. And I'll start with a demonstration which takes sensor data from the outside world and puts it into Windows Azure storage. So the idea is to turbocharge this resource-constrained device to be able to consume a vast amount of storage in the cloud. And we'll do that in two ways. We'll store in table storage a value every time it reads something, and if we press the button on the NetDuino, it will cause it to upload the entire log of everything it's run in that entire sequence up into a blob at the same time. So important here, we have NetIO, we have crypto for authenticating and using SHA-256 hashes to make sure that the message going to Azure is authenticated. We're using interrupt port to press that button, and we're using FileIO to store that blob before we put it into the cloud. The pattern in the real world is that you will reduce the resource constraint on these devices by using the cloud as a backing store. So I'll go into Visual Studio and run. Oh, ReSharper 7 is available. I don't think I'll do that now. Okay, so we'll see in this demonstration that we use a account name and account key, which is very important. Which is how you communicate up to Windows Azure storage. You have to get a network time from an NTP server, which is time.windows.com, in order to set the time on the device, because every time you unplug it, it forgets the time. So why is that important? Well, Windows Azure has a security feature, which is that if you're not sending a message up with the date property within 15 minutes of what the server thinks it is, it rejects your request. We're going to use a MAC address from the device to say which device is sending this message, and that's going to be the partition key in table storage. And we are going to create a table called netmfdata. We're going to go through, I've got a few breakpoints here, and we're going to add a table entity for temperature. And remember, this is our implementation of the table client. It's not the standard Microsoft implementation. It's something we've written ourselves, and it's open source, so I'll make this available after the session. And what we will do at the same time after we've added this is put a blob on the SD card so that when we later want to transfer the entire blob and we push this button, we can do so. So let's go right ahead and start this application. So we'll do that, and we'll have a look at the output window at the same time. So we're going to see that we are deploying to the device 55 kilobytes of code. Takes a little bit of while, but you'll get there eventually. Okay, assembly is successfully deployed to the device. And now we'll expect to see this break into a debug session, which it has done. And we see it continues to write debugging information down here. Now we can step through, as we would do normally, F10, to make sure that we delete any existing data. And we will get a network time. The network time we got back is a current date time, as you can see. And that means that over in England, it's very, very late. So anyone who's watching me, hello, and you should probably be in bed. We will go through and we'll create our classes that we want to, and we'll set up a table. So we've here, resource has been created. Now that's an interesting thing, isn't it? So if I go into my favorite cloud storage explorer, which is Cloud Storage Studio by Cerebrata, and I see that previously I had zero tables. If I refresh this, and I've created a NetMF data table. Well, that's great, isn't it? Let's carry on going. Let's create our input port. Let's set up the interrupt. Let's create an analog port, and I'll show you what that's doing in a moment. That's a potentiometer, which is faking out a temperature. So we're going to take a reading from that potentiometer, and we're going to multiply it by 40 degrees, or 40 as a decimal, and we're going to assert that that is actually the current temperature. So we're going to run through a counter for the row key alongside the partition key. We're going to read the data. It's 0 degrees at the moment, so when it comes back to here, I'll change the value on the potentiometer, and the value that goes up to the cloud will be different. So now I'm going to add a table entity for temperature, and we'll look down here, and we'll see that resource has been created. So let's go back to Cerebrata and see that the table here has got one row, temperature of 0, we're in the UK, and that's right now. We'll go back, we'll create a local file. We'll use a file stream, very familiar C# technology or .NET technologies. We'll write the values that we want in there, which is the MAC address, the time, and the data, which is the temperature. And we'll flush that out, and then we'll loop again. We'll sleep for a second, because we want to record every 1 second the temperature. Okay, and then we're going to come up to counter number 2. And before we do this, I will increase the value of the potentiometer. So hopefully now we'll get a different value from this analog input.read. And indeed we do. Now I've increased it only a small amount, and it's now 8 degrees. We'll add a table value for that. And we shall skip round. And I shall increase it again. And it's now 24 degrees. And then I'll just turn it back to where it was. One last time. Back to 0. And then we go into our Cloud Storage Studio one more time. And refresh the data in here. And we can see we have 0, 8.9, 24, and 0 again. So we are using the cloud as a store for what we're detecting on this device right here. And what I'll do now is I'll get rid of these breakpoints, let it carry on going. And we'll see in the background that it will carry on doing all kinds of stuff. Sleeping for a second, going through again, going through again. And I'll press the interrupt port. And because I did that, oh, I didn't have a breakpoint there. Well, that was a bit annoying. I'll do that again then. Okay, there we go. We're going to see two blobs now because I missed the first one. I didn't have a breakpoint where I needed to. And what it's doing is putting the blob, using the blob client, onto Azure from the SD card. And we do that, and we see that it was successful, true. So we'll stop debugging, and I'll just show you those blobs. Back to there. We'll just refresh this at the same time. Okay, so there were the values that went up. I didn't change the potentiometer, so it stayed at the freezing point. And what I did was I created in the blob, the demo container, I created two files, which were just now. And the timestamp indicates which one was first, which was that one was first, this one was second. Let's just open the view blob. And that's opened over here, so let's drag over there, and you can see they're the same values that we put up there. So we're also using blob storage to store our data. Excellent. Okay, so back to the slide deck. Demo number two. What we're going to do now is using very similar techniques, but a slightly more fun approach. We're going to use a Windows Azure storage queue in order to communicate between two devices. One is going to send messages and one is going to receive messages, and they're going to interact together. So this is a disconnected two devices, both connected over the public internet, but no physical connection between the two, and using the cloud with Windows Azure storage queues in order to connect the two together. Important here, similar things, output ports though. We are going to light something up to make this more evident about what's going on. We're going to use a scalable command of the remote and disconnected devices. Now, what are we doing? We're taking a lead from the Sharks with Freaking Lasers Windows Azure challenge, which was recently. And we have Dr. Evil's pet, which is a shark with a freaking laser. And that's going to chomp and zap at Austin Powers. And Austin's got a mojo, so he's going to try and heal himself. And what we're going to do is build a little game which shows an LED strip, which you can see here. And it's going to be the value of Austin Powers' health. So let's plug everything in, because I need just one extra power supply here. Let's hope I don't electrocute myself. That's good. And let's go to the correct Visual Studio instance, which is this one. And let's go over there. Oh, ReSharper 7.1 is available. This is some kind of guerrilla marketing. But JetBrains are a lovely bunch of guys, so I don't mind that. Let's skip this update. I probably should have remembered that. It goes back over there. OK, so what do? Again, we set the network time. We create a queue client this time, rather than the blob or a table client. We create an LED strip, which is communicating over a technology called serial peripheral interface. And we will, using the mode, which is Austin with a shark with a freaking laser on the same freaking device, because we only have one network connection here, this is going to act as though it's both sending and receiving the message, but this is easily broken apart. And I put this online later as an open source project. You will be able to download this and run it on two separate devices by swapping this flag between Austin, which you can see is this if statement here, the shark with the freaking laser, or Austin with the shark and the freaking laser on the same freaking device. So what will happen anyway is this bit here will be skipped, and it will go into this section here where there's a guy in a tuxedo who's called Austin and a shark with a freaking laser. And what's going to happen is that we have two timers setting up background threads, a healing mojo and a damage retriever. The damage retriever goes over to the cloud and tries to pull down what the shark with the freaking laser has been doing. And the shark with the freaking laser zaps and chomps, which is sending messages up to the Windows Azure storage queue. So in the interest of time, let's get going. So we're deploying. This is 55.8 kilobytes, which is very similar size to the last one, slightly larger. Most of the size is taken up by the libraries that you include, not your own code. So it doesn't really matter that this is quite a bit larger. It's the libraries that you include take up that space. And we just sit around and wait for this to happen. Aha, there we go. We have successfully deployed. And we're going to step through. Oops, potentially blocked. OK, that was good. That's a bad breakpoint that actually went away. So let's hopefully just F5 will take us back somewhere useful. OK, we're setting the local time again, creating this queue client, initializing a strip, and then we are Austin Powers with a shark with a freaking laser on the same device. We create our classes, create our healing mojo, and we'll start seeing things. He's very, very groovy, baby, at the moment. And forever, in a wild true loop, we're going to light up a strip, which tells us how well he is. And then Dr. Evil's present is going to zap, and he's zapped for 19. So if we just F5 and let this run through, and we watch the values, you see at the moment now, hopefully you can see this, we're getting blue LEDs, which is that the shark with the freaking laser is winning, and that the green LEDs are decreasing. And now, in fact, he's completely lost his mojo because it's completely gone blue. But now it's come back because he's got some mojo back. Oh, no, he's lost it again. But what we're doing here is just communicating between a device and the cloud and then pulling the result down and then interacting with the peripheral. So I'll go back now to my demo, my last demo. I'll unplug that because otherwise it will completely go wrong. Let's debug, stop that. Okay, cool. Hope you enjoyed that, a little bit of fun. Again, open source later on, so you can see that. And let's move on to our final demo, which is about controlling Windows Azure itself with these devices. So what I want to do is I want to say that in this scenario, I've got a very busy website or cloud service, and I want to scale it up. But I can't scale it up because I'm not on my desktop and my phone's run out of battery. So all I have is a watch, and this watch has got a dial on it. And that dial is a potentiometer, and it's connected to a Netduino inside this watch. And it's got an Ethernet connection. It's not necessarily the best watch in the world. You probably change that to some other kind of network connectivity. But the idea is I want to scale up the number of instances I have, and I go like this on my watch. It sends a message up to Windows Azure, and rather than having one instance of my website, I suddenly have 2, 3, 4, 5. So let's go on to how you can do that. Now, I can't do that directly from my Netduino because I haven't compiled in the security libraries, which you can do, but if I had done that, I would have had less code space for the rest of my applications and not all of them would have run. But imagine I take a vanilla Netduino, I can't use the cryptography libraries, so instead, what I have to do is use a gateway pattern, where I send a message up to this gateway, and it, in a more fully featured client, can do the work for me. So basically what I'm going to do is supplement the limitation of this device, which is that it has no SSL and no management certificates on board, to use a custom gateway and handle this transport for me. So let's just start off by going to my portal, and I see that at the moment I have a NetMF MVC. Oh, that's the wrong screen. Let's go over here. So this is the Windows Azure management portal. I'm sure you've seen it quite a lot today at the Windows Azure conference. What we have is one core running in this NetMF MVC application. And what we want to do is change that to 2 or 3 or 5, depending on what it says on the value of my potentiometer that I have locally. So let's jump right into the code. Here we go. Ah, be sharper, more good advertising, thanks. But okay, so what we're going to do is run very quickly. And we see the output. This is a very simple one. It's actually the simplest of all the demos. And it's only 42 kilobytes. And hopefully that means I've got time to do it. And there's only a very few number of size left, so you're going to get time to go and have your coffee very soon. Here we go, 42 kilobytes. When that happens, what you do is you unplug it, because I've probably got some funny state on my device because of all the other demos I've been doing. And I simply deploy again. And that was the demo gods cursing me for saying I've got time to do it. Here we go, we're going to see we should be deploying the same amount of data. Okay, successfully deployed. We're going to get the current state of the Windows Azure storage. It's going to tell us how many instances we've got running, which, by the way, you can see here by just loading up this. It's just going to say the number of instances, the names of those roles inside Windows Azure. We'll come back to that in a minute. So what we'll do is we'll get the current state. There you go, one instance at the moment. It's called NetMF host instance 0. We see that the current state is that there is one instance running. We get our potentiometer value, which is, again, the analog input, and we multiply it by a factor of 10. And we see at the moment that's 0.6, so it's not high enough. Let's just do some great Visual Studio work and go back up there and increase the value of that potentiometer and come back through. Oh, great. That's because I didn't go back to the right point. That was probably already reading something. Let's try that again. Okay, cool. So it's a lot quicker the second time we deploy something. It's already there. Just have to reattach. Okay, here we go. Current state. Was 1, get the value of that, which is 2. So it's going to, what I'm doing is using a CAS from a double to an int. So it's not going to round that up to 3 for me. It's going to strip off everything after the 2. So what it's going to do is set the current state to 2 instances rather than 1. So let's just go into there and we'll just show that data parameter is in fact 2. What it's doing is creating this HTTP web request, going up to our gateway, run through, and it's going to block on that. And if we go back to our portal, we'll see that we go to our dashboard any second now. We should see this becomes transitioning. Sometimes there's a small problem with refreshing the page, but it should become transitioning because it's trying to provision those new things. Aha, the deployment is transitioning. So that is exactly what we expect. What it's done is we've sent a message up to the fabric. The fabric has accepted it and is now working on provisioning those new instances for us. And you can see, look, two instances. It's gone from one instance to two instances, just like that, by turning a potentiometer. We've used the device to control the cloud, and I think that's freaking awesome. So let's go back to our slides, and we'll just round off with one last thought. And that thought is big data. We have 22 billion devices by 2020. How are we going to get any kind of sense from all that data that they're sending up to us? If we imagine, even right now, if we just go with the 9 billion that are around right now, if those devices send 1 kilobyte each, maybe an hour, maybe a day, maybe a minute to a website, and it gets stored in the cloud, that equates to 9 petabytes of data from all these devices. All kinds of different scenarios, all kinds of different sessions. How do we get any meaning out of that? And the only reason, the only way of doing that is to use something like big data, HD Insight, or what was formerly known as Hadoop on Azure, which gives you the ability to gain sense from this scale of data. Now that brings me to the end of the talk, and I'd like to thank you for listening. Thank you very much.